Well, we are continuing this afternoon with our study of the minor prophets. We have managed to get through, I think, six of the books so far. This will be number seven, I think. But we've tried for the most part to review the books in somewhat of a chronological order. They're not in our Bibles in chronological order. There are a couple of the minor prophets that we really can't specifically pinpoint the date of their writing. And so this is one of those books that we'll be reviewing this afternoon. It's also very likely one of the most, the least frequently referenced books in the Bible. Now, there may be a few of the minor prophets that will be in that category, but this one is possibly one of the least read or referred to of any of the minor prophets themselves. We're going to be reviewing, if I asked you, what is your favorite memory scripture from the book of Obadiah? What would that be? Probably nothing comes quickly to mind. So let's begin and go through a study this afternoon of the book of Obadiah. Now, as you turn to it, I'll give you about 10 minutes to find it. You will note that Obadiah, if you didn't already remember this, is just one chapter. In fact, only 21 verses in length. So as I sat down earlier in the week and started thinking about the study today, I thought, well, that'll be quick. I can go through maybe a couple of books in this study and not spend a whole study on the one chapter of Obadiah. But that's not the way it works out. When we look at this book or think of it, again, there's not a lot that springs to mind about the man Obadiah, or most likely, or possibly at least, about the prophecy that he wrote. But there's really an interesting backstory to this book, and there's a lot of information here that we can learn that has to do both with history and with prophecy. And I believe that there is prophecy in this book that is very relevant, even to some of the things that we see happening today. So we will spend this study reviewing the book of Obadiah. Nothing is known of him at all other than his name. The only time that his name is mentioned in Scripture is here in chapter 1, verse 1, the vision of Obadiah. The name means servant of the eternal. That's the meaning of the Hebrew that is translated Obadiah. There are some scholars who believe that perhaps that was a title rather than a name. Now, I don't know how they would conclude that since they don't know anything about him. God names things what they are, and I think we can accept this as the name of the prophet. And he was a servant of the eternal. The book of Obadiah, or the chapter of Obadiah, deals with the history and the future of Edom. Edom, again, is not something that a subject or a group of people that draw a lot of our attention. But there are many prophecies about Edom when we look at it, when we consider it. There are many other prophecies besides this one that are on the subject or the topic of the people of Edom. And I think if we think about the number of prophecies about this group and the intensity, as we'll see, of the prophecies that are about Edom, it should draw our attention and emphasize that there is something important that's going on here, something that's valuable for us to understand. I also would suggest, and we'll develop this a bit as we continue, that some of the conditions that are right now coming about in the Middle East, some of the trends, some of the acts of warfare and terrorism that are taking place in that region, have to do with the people that are discussed in this book. And I believe they will have a great deal of relevance to the modern nations of Israel in the future, perhaps in the very near future. Now, I'm not sure that we're addressing the book of Obadiah at a chronological point in our development or our study of the minor prophets. Obadiah is a book that is difficult to date. We don't know exactly when it was written or when Obadiah's work was accomplished. There are a couple of possibilities that the scholars suggest. There is a reference in 2 Chronicles chapter 21, verses 16 and 17, as a reference to a time when the Philistines and the Arabians, a very general term, attacked Judah during the time of King Jehoram of Judah. And because of the reference to the Arabians and the Philistines, some scholars believe that perhaps the book of Obadiah was written to refer to those events. If that is the case, then Obadiah was written at a very early date. It would have been perhaps one of the minor prophets. That would place it in the mid-800s B.C. On the other extreme, there is a prophecy in Jeremiah that is very similar to Obadiah. And some believe that the prophecy in Jeremiah chapter 49, which we'll look at in a little bit, was written at the same time. If that's the case, then the book was written much later. It would have been in around 586 or 590 B.C., something in that time frame. So the bottom line is, or the conclusion we reach is that it's really not clear when the book or the prophecy was given. But one thing that we can be certain of is that it doesn't matter, because this was a prophecy given to Obadiah from God, and Obadiah delivered that. And we know that many of the prophecies, for example, in Daniel, were written hundreds of years before they were accomplished. And so Obadiah could have been written back in the 800s, or it may have been written later in the 500s B.C. Since it's a message from God, it doesn't really matter in that sense at what point it was given. Verse 1 tells us, as I just mentioned, that this prophecy is directed to Edom. As we look through this chapter, we see that in verse 9, there's also a reference to someone named Teman, T-E-M-A-N. And there are, throughout this book, seven references to Esau. So we'll be seeing as we continue that all three of these refer to the same people. The people of Edom are the descendants of Esau. And that's stated very clearly in these two passages we'll be looking at. If you look at your Bible map in the back of your Bible, you'll see that the land of Edom is southeast of the nation of Israel. It's toward Judah, more specifically. It's south of the southern border and east of the area of the nation of Israel. And it's located in an area that today would include most of the nation of Jordan. We're going to see, we're going to review a little bit of the history of Edom as we continue. We'll see that the histories of Edom and Israel are very much entwined. There's a very close relationship between the people of Edom and the people of Jacob, or the people of Israel. And in fact, there has been a deep animosity and hostility between the people of Edom and the people of Israel that goes way back to the earliest days. It goes back to the birth of twin brothers named Jacob and Esau. So let's review a little bit of that history and see what are the roots of the relationship between the nations of Israel and the people of Edom. I want to begin in Genesis chapter 25. We're going to spend probably half of our time, maybe even more than that, reviewing this history before we even get to the book of, or to the book of Obadiah. But I think it's helpful because it sets in context that prophecy that we will be reviewing. In Genesis 25, we'll begin here in verse 21. Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren. Of course, we know that Isaac is the son of Abraham and Sarah. Sarah was not able to bear children until very late in her life when, by a miraculous intervention, she gave birth to Isaac. Isaac's wife, Rebekah, was also initially unable to bear children. So Isaac prayed about that and asked God to give them that blessing. And it says in verse 21, the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. But the children struggled together within her. And she said, "If all is well, why am I like this? What is going on?" is what she was wondering. Now, when a woman is pregnant, it's very exciting to her when she begins to feel the baby move. And that life that's within her becomes more real to her as she senses and notices the movement of the baby. But this was something more than just the baby moving. As we continue, we see what it was that was troubling her. She was having a difficult pregnancy, and she was concerned about it because it wasn't just movement. It was something much more than that. So she inquired of the Lord, and he said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." Rebekah was having twins, and they weren't just moving within her womb. They were already fighting and struggling against each other. This happened even before they were born. They were already at odds. And we'll see a little more about that as we continue. So not only are they twins, but they're two different peoples. And there's going to be some rivalry, apparently, between them because the younger is going to wind up serving the older. Continuing on in verse 24, when her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed, there were twins in her womb, and the first came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over. So they named him Hairy. That's what the name Esau means. They named him Hairy. And afterward, his brother was born. He came out immediately after Hairy was born because he came out with his hand holding his brother's heel. So they named him Heel Holder. That's the actual meaning of the name Jacob. He was literally grasping onto and holding the heel of his brother. Now, that name is interpreted to mean a supplanter. The reason he was hanging on to that heel was because he was struggling with and trying to take the place of that brother. That was evident from their birth. The name Jacob is interpreted to mean supplanter, or one who supersedes or takes the place of another. So the twins were born, and there was difficulty and struggle between them before they were born and even at their birth. So the boys grew, it says in verse 27. Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a mild man. The word mild, if you have a New King James translation. In my center reference, it says the word mild could also be translated complete. It gives the sense that Jacob was a more balanced person than Esau was. Esau was a very strong personality, and he was dedicated to the outdoors and to this lifestyle of a hunter. He was a man of the field. Jacob was a complete man, or a more balanced person, dwelling in tents. In other words, he at least came indoors once in a while. He had a very different approach than Esau did. Now, Esau and Jacob are twins. We would call them fraternal twins. They were not identical twins. They were conceived. They were two separate eggs fertilized by two different sperm at the same time. So they were completely different from one another. And we see that so clearly in this description of them, that one is stronger than the other. One has a different appearance than the other. One has a different sense of balance or lifestyle than the other. So they grew up very different from one another in appearance, in personality, in character, in temperament. Everything about them was different. So the boys grew. Esau, again, was a skillful hunter. Jacob was a mild man. You've got these twin brothers, Harry and Jake, and they're very different from each other. Now, what further complicates the matter is what we see in verse 28. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. So not only were they different, but their parents treated them differently. Each of them had a favorite. And I'm sure that it was evident to them that mom favored Jacob, Isaac favored Esau. In verse 29, the account continues that as this would have occurred after they were grown, that Jacob was cooking a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary. So this, again, even illustrates the differences in their characteristics. Esau was a man of the kitchen. He was able to prepare a mean stew, and he was working away to prepare this meal when Esau came in from the field. Now, it must have been an unsuccessful day of hunting for Esau, because he didn't have anything to eat, and he was extremely hungry and exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, verse 30, please feed me with that same red stew, or it says later it's a lentil soup, for I am weary. Therefore, his name was called Edom. So Harry has a nickname. Harry's nickname is Edom, and Edom means red. And so he was wanting this stew, which apparently was reddish in appearance. He himself was red. It says in verse 25, that he had a red appearance. Maybe he had red hair, light complexion, maybe, you know, freckles. I don't know. But he had this reddish appearance. And so that and the soup that he lusted after combined to give him this nickname of Edom, or red. Now Jacob said to him, verse 31, sell me your birthright as of this day. Jacob had his eye on that birthright as soon as he understood what it was. Now, these are the grandsons of Abraham. And so most likely they even knew Abraham as they were growing up. And Rebekah, who favored Jacob, most likely told him all about that birthright that had been promised, the blessings that were promised to Abraham directly, and that was the birthright that would be passed along to their son. And Rebekah taught Jacob, I would speculate, to respect and to realize the importance of being the grandson of Abraham, to receive the blessing and the promises that were given to Abraham initially. So Jacob was very interested in that birthright. Esau, on the other hand, didn't seem to have much respect for the birthright. I don't know. I'm guessing perhaps didn't have much respect for his grandfather. Perhaps didn't think much about what he was being told or taught by his parents or by his grandparents. But he just really didn't regard the birthright as being valuable. He said, "What good is a birthright if I die?" in verse 32. I really doubt that he was literally going to starve to death, that he couldn't somehow crawl back to his home and find a meal of some sort. But he felt that the birthright was of no value, but this meal was important to him. He seemed to be a person of the moment. So Jacob said, "Well, swear to me this day." So he swore to him, and he sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils. And he ate and he drank, and he got up and he went his way. Again, I think that the point to recognize here is the importance that Jacob placed on the birthright and the respect that that seems to indicate, not only for his grandfather, but for the promises that were given to him by God. Jacob seemed to have some belief in that and therefore found that birthright to be something of very great value. Now, of course, Jacob had this aggressive personality and character, the supplanter's point of view of everything, and probably a very competitive person, and was willing to take advantage of his brother to get what was best for him. And Jacob had some lessons to learn. And as you see the story unfold, there's a little bit of what we might call poetic justice when Jacob meets up with Laban. His uncle Laban was just as much of a conniver as Jacob was. And Jacob got a lot of what he dished out when he worked for Laban for some period of time, for many years. So we see here then these brothers, and we see that they are very different and that they have a rivalry between them, and that Jacob takes advantage of his older brother, older by maybe seconds. Let's continue down into chapter 27. That's where the story continues. There's another one incident here between. We'll pick up the thread of the story in chapter 27. It came to pass, verse 1, when Isaac was old and his eyes were dim, so dim he could not see, that he called Esau, his older son, and he said to him, "My son," and Esau answered, "Here I am." And Isaac said, "Behold, now I am old. I do not know the day of my death. So please take your weapons and go out to the field and hunt game for me and make me savory food such as I love and bring it to me that I may eat and that my soul may bless you before I die." This is a very important moment. This was the time when those blessings, those promises that were given initially to Abraham would be passed along. You see, Abraham had one son, one son of promise, and that was Isaac. And so Isaac was the one who received the blessings that were passed initially to Abraham. But having two sons, Isaac realized that he would pass along that blessing formally to the next generation, and he would have to choose his son that he would pass it along to. So naturally, Isaac chose the son that he favored. He chose Esau, was the one that he intended to give, pass along the blessing to. Two reasons. First of all, he was older. Esau was technically the older of these twin boys. And secondly, again, Isaac simply liked him better. He favored Esau. Probably didn't, at least there's no indication that he gave much thought to which of his sons was really in the best position to receive that blessing, who had the characteristics, who appreciated it, who seemed to be more inclined to take those blessings and to deal with them effectively. He was prepared to pass along the blessing to Esau. Rebekah overheard the conversation, and you know the story there, that she and Jacob hatched this plan to trick Isaac into giving the blessing to Jacob. Let's drop down to verse 19. Jacob has prepared this meal. His mother helped him to do so, and he brought it to his father. And Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I've done just as you told me. Please arise, sit down, and eat my game, that your soul may bless me." Again, he's achieved the birthright. He has the birthright. Now he wants to receive the blessing. Jacob just simply stole the blessing from Esau through this deception. Now we saw, though, earlier in chapter 25 that it was God's intention from the beginning, before they were even born, that the younger would dominate the older. So God intended for Jacob to receive the birthright and the blessing. But this is an example of a human jumping in to take things in his own hands. And we see some long-term consequences from that action that Jacob took. Now, frankly, Jacob didn't know that he was the one who was going to receive the birthright and the blessing. He just wanted it. And so he went out to get it. And he wondered, what would have happened if Jacob had been patient? What would have happened if Jacob had waited for God to have transferred that birthright and that blessing to him the way he would have? Well, we will never know what could have happened. But we do know what Jacob did. And this deception, this effort that Jacob and his mother went to, changes the course of history. And it sets into motion some events that will cause a great deal of pain and difficulty throughout history. So, Jacob intercedes here, and he steals the blessing. He carries out the deception. As you read through here, you notice that Isaac was a bit suspicious all the way through. It just didn't seem right. It didn't sound like Esau at all, but Jacob had disguised himself and put on some things to make him seem to be Esau. And Isaac reluctantly accepted that it was Esau and brought him nearer to him. It says in verse 25, to eat the meal. Verse 26, "Come near now and let me and kiss me, my son." Probably what Isaac was trying to do was figure out, is this really Esau or not? And so he just wanted to get as close to him as he could. He came near and he kissed him, and he smelled the smell of his clothing. It was part of the disguise that Jacob had. And finally, Isaac was convinced enough that he passed along the blessing. "Surely," verse 27, "the smell of my son is like the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed. Therefore," and here comes the blessing that's given to Jacob, "may God give you of the dew of heaven, of the fatness of the earth, and plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brethren, and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be those who bless you." So this was at least part of, and we'll see a little more in a minute, of the blessing that Isaac transfers or bestows upon Jacob, the blessing and the promises initially given to Abraham. So after this was given then to Jacob, what was left for Esau? That's what he wanted to know, because he came in immediately after this blessing had been given to Jacob, as you see in the next few verses, and is stunned to find out what has just happened. And he cries out to his father, verse 34, "to bless me also, my father." Well, he had already given or extended in this formal manner the blessing of Abraham to Jacob. So what was left to give to Esau? We read that blessing, and we might put the word blessing in quotes, in verses 39 and 40. And I'll read these two verses from the New Revised Standard Version, because the King James is a little bit difficult here to see just what it is that Isaac was saying to him. In verse 39 from the New Revised Standard, this is what Isaac told Esau. Away from the fatness of the earth shall your home be, and away from the dew of heaven on high. By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. But when you break loose, you shall break his yoke from his neck, from your neck. So this prayer for Esau, this blessing, almost sounds like a curse, that he would be away from all of the blessings, separated from the blessings and the good things that were given to Jacob, and that he would survive on his wits and on his strength. He would survive by the sword. Jacob would survive because he had such rich wealth from the blessings that God would bestow upon him. Esau, in effect, would have to fight for his survival. But there's a hint at the end of verse 40 that eventually things would turn around and Esau's descendants would have the upper hand when he would break the yoke of his brother. We'll continue on into chapter 28. Isaac accepted the fact that Jacob had received the blessing. And so Isaac called Jacob in verse 1 and further blessed him. I know that the Bible is always, these stories are abbreviated as far as what really happened and what some of the experience might have been like in the relationship. But you have to kind of wonder how Isaac felt and what else he might have said to Jacob before he got around to blessing him again. Because I'm sure he was not pleased with the way he had been deceived. But we don't have any record of their interaction, their relationship. We just are told here that Isaac called Jacob and he blessed him and he commanded him. And he said to him, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. Arise and go to Paddan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father." Paddan Aram is in the north of the area of Canaan. It's in the region called Haran, which is where Abraham and his father had been for a while before Abraham was sent down to Canaan. It's near the nation of Syria. And Bethuel is called a Syrian in verse 5, not because he was Syrian by ethnicity, but he lived in the area of Syria. So Isaac instructs Jacob to marry within their family. This was important because, again, of the blessing that God was passing through the family of Abraham. And he instructed his son Jacob to marry within that family, to go to Laban, his mother's brother, Jacob's uncle, and live with the family and find a wife from among their people. Then in verses 3 and 4, we find additional description or detail of the blessing that was given to Isaac, by Isaac to Jacob. "May God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may be an assembly of peoples, and give you the blessing of Abraham to you and your descendants with you, that you may inherit the land in which you are a stranger, which God gave to Abraham." So Jacob, personally, is told that he, as Abraham was promised, or his descendants would inherit that land of Canaan. It was the physical inheritance that was given to the descendants of Abraham, and it was to be given to them through Jacob. Now, Esau also became a pretty good-sized nation. Edom was a large group of people. But Jacob and his descendants received this special blessing of prosperity and a life that was just blessed because of the land that they would live in. They would inherit the land that was productive and was where they could raise the crops and the flocks, and a place where they could live in abundance. So Isaac sent Jacob away, verse 5. He went to Paddan Aram to Laban, his the son of Bethuel the Syrian, again, Syrian by location, not by race or ethnicity, the brother of Rebekah, the mother of Jacob and Esau. So it just, again, makes it clear that Jacob went to his family and that he married within that family, which eventually became the family of Israel. So what does Esau do? Verse 6. Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Padan Aram to take himself a wife from there, and that he blessed them, that he gave him a charge or a command, saying, "You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan." So what did Esau do? When he saw that his birthright was gone, the blessing had been taken from him, and his brother had been commanded or ordered to marry within the family and not to marry from the Canaanites, Esau, verse 8, saw that the daughters of Canaan did not please his father, so he married a Canaanite. Again, this shows the attitude that Esau had. Now, I suppose anyone in that situation would be a bit petulant and be a bit frustrated at what had just happened to him. But in order to further disrespect and defy his own family, he intentionally married into the Canaanites. He went to Ishmael and took Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister, and so on, and to be his wife. So he married into the other side of the family, through Ishmael, who originated the people of the tribes of Canaan. So, again, to summarize, we see these two brothers. They're twins, but they're entirely different. And God intended them to be the fathers of two separate nations. And we see that Jacob has aroused the hostility and the animosity of his brother Esau by stealing from him what Esau felt was his by birth. And so there's a serious breach between them. And in fact, Jacob fled from the land, not only just to find a wife, but because he was fearful that Esau would try to kill him. Again, it shows, doesn't it, the character, the kind of person that Esau must have been. So I won't continue this thread of the story for now. We know that Jacob went into that region. He met Rachel, and he married Leah first, and then Rachel and his family. The blessings began to come to him. From this point, let's skip ahead to Genesis 36. Genesis 36, we know a little more about the family of Jacob, his two wives, his two concubines, his 12 sons, and he also had a daughter, and that they became the tribes of Israel. We don't know so much about Esau's descendants. Chapter 36 gives the genealogy of Esau, which it says, or who, is Edom. So again, when we read of Edom in Obadiah, we're talking about the descendants of Esau. His genealogy is given in this chapter. Drop down here to verse 6. Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all the persons of his household, his cattle and all his animals, all his goods which he had gained in the land of Canaan, and he left. All the wealth that Esau had accumulated was while he was living in Canaan. But remember, the prophecy was, or the blessing that was given to Esau, was that he would live away from the blessings of Jacob, away from the fat of the land, away from the dew from heaven. And so whatever wealth Esau had accumulated was while he still lived in Canaan. When Jacob returned, brought his family with him, there was no longer room in that immediate vicinity for both of these clans to continue to live. And so Esau left. He went away from his brother Jacob, and he went into a different area. He went to, says in verse 8, to Mount Seir. Mount Seir is in the area southeast of of Israel, or where Judah wound up being. And again, it is where the nation of Edom was established. Mount Seir is a desolate, desert region, mountainous and isolated. It is away from the blessings of Jacob. And it required Esau then to live not by the wealth of the land, but to fight to make his own way. And his life changed when he moved away from Canaan and went to Mount Seir. He took with him the breach, and that breach between the brothers was never healed. Now, Esau was prevented from doing harm to Jacob. Remember the scene where Jacob is coming back home and he's fearful that his brother who's coming to meet him, just a casual, a meeting with his brother, and he brought 300 of his army with him. That was a bit ominous. But God prevented Esau from taking physical vengeance on Jacob. But there's a breach between them that was never healed. Now let's look a little further into the descendants of Esau that we see here in this chapter. Verse 10, these were the names of Esau's sons. Eliphaz is the son that was mentioned in verse 10. Verse 11, the sons of Eliphaz were Teman and several others. Teman, again, is mentioned in Obadiah. So when Teman is mentioned, it is in reference to the descendants of Esau. Teman would have been a grandson of Esau. Verse 12, Timnah was the concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bore him Amalek. Amalek may be a name that is familiar. The Amalekites, as they developed into a tribe, were among the most bitter of Israel's enemies throughout their history. The Amalekites were a tribe that was very aggressive and that had caused really nothing but grief to the people of Israel throughout their history, even from the very beginning. Notice in Exodus 17. Exodus 17 is describing an event that took place within a few weeks after Israel had left Egypt. Remember, they passed through the Red Sea, and then they went 3 days into the desert, and they didn't have water, and God provided them with water by a miracle. Then they continued on for about another 3 or 4 weeks, if you follow the story. And they came again to a situation where they needed water very desperately. But it's just a matter of weeks from the time they had left Egypt. And the first people to resist Israel after they left Egypt were the Amalekites. Verse 8 of Exodus 17. Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. Amalek came and picked a fight with Israel. Doesn't seem to be any particular reason for it. Here's this group of people wandering through the desert, perhaps that because they seemed to be defenseless, perhaps because they had a lot of stuff with them, they just looted the people of Egypt, and they looked like an easy target. But there was no particular reason other than that Amalek saw that they could take advantage. As had been told to Esau, they were living by the sword. It's probably how they made their way from that point forward, by taking advantage of others and robbing them. So Amalek came to attack Israel. And you remember the story is the situation where Moses went up on the top of the mountain, and as long as he held his arms up, the people of Israel prevailed. But when his arms got tired and he lowered his arms, then the Amalekites began to take charge of the battle. And so Joshua and others propped up Moses' arms so that he would be able to sustain that position, that posture, so that Israel would win the battle. Verse 13, Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Verse 14 is interesting. Write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua. And this is something that God said that he would do. I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. God said that he would blot out these descendants of Esau. We're going to come back to that thought in a little bit. Verse 16 also says that the Lord has sworn, he's promised to do this, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. So this blotting out of Amalek was going to take a while because there'll be several generations that are going to pass where the people of Amalek continue to do battle with the people of God. Just a thought to kind of keep in mind. This was at the very beginning of Israel's time in the wilderness. We can look ahead to Numbers chapter 20. We come here to the conclusion, to the end of Israel's wandering through the wilderness. Here in Numbers 20, this is shortly before Israel goes into their promised land. Notice in chapter or verse 14 in Numbers 20, as they're traveling, now they're in the... They've come out of the peninsula of Arabia. Mount Sinai is at the southern tip of that. And they're making their way north toward their final entry into the promised land. Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom. So Edom was already developing in this area, southeast of where Israel would be established. And they were passing through that land. Thus says your brother, Israel. So there's still this understanding, this acknowledgement of the connection between Israel and Edom. And Moses appeals to them as part of the family. And if you read through these next few verses, all they're asking to do is to walk through the land of Edom on their way to their land that God is giving to them. Moses said, we're not going to drink any water. We won't let our livestock eat any of the grass. All we want to do is walk along the king's highway, is what it was called, to pass through your land. In verse 21, Edom refused to give Israel passage through his territory. So, again, we see evidence that there is still this animosity between Edom and Israel. And apparently, an understanding, a connection between them. Edom knew what the history was and how they wound up living as they were in their more difficult circumstances. And they knew of the promises that would go to this people of Israel. They were the family of Jacob, and they had that resentment for them. It's interesting, isn't it, that politicians, especially American politicians, seem to think they can waltz on into the Middle East and just sit these people down at a table and sort out all the problems and solve everything. How many times has that been tried? And every time, it's a complete and utter failure. And a week later, they're back lobbing bombs at each other across the Gaza Strip. What they don't understand is that this is the history. This is part of the prophecy, too, that these brothers would be at odds, that they would fight against one another, and that one would resent the other for the promises or the blessings and the good things that they have. And so there is no president or secretary of state or any leader of any American government or human government that's going to walk in and solve this problem. It is something that will be resolved by Jesus Christ when he returns. So the Amalekites are the bad guys that kind of follow through, but they're descendants of Edom. Who are the Edomites today? Esau, again, is living in the land southeast of Israel. It's a desolate, mountainous region that was away from the blessings that Jacob inherited. In the past, we've said in a very general sense that the descendants of Edom are the modern nation of Turkey. Now, there is some truth to that. There are Edomites within the ethnic groups of Turkey. But to say that Edom equals Turkey, and to draw a little outline on a map and say, well, here's Edom today, that's really probably too simplistic. Because we find footprints of Esau's descendants all throughout that region. Turkey, in Iraq, in Iran, and other areas throughout that Western Asia area of the Middle East. In fact, the rabbis in Israel, at least in some of the rabbinical schools, teach that the descendants of the Amalekites are the Palestinian Arabs, those that live closest to the nation of Israel and have the strongest sense of hatred for the people of the nation of Israel. But it's not just there either. The population of Jordan, as we mentioned, it's now the nation of Jordan is in this area where Edom was originally settled. Jordan's population has quite a lot of Palestinians, and many of them, it would seem, are Edomite by descent. We find, again, records, or I should say, kind of footprints of the people of Edom scattered all throughout the Middle East. There's a city in Iraq we hear of often called Basra. Well, one of the major cities of the nation of Edom was Bozra, Bozrah. And the nation in Iraq is Basra, perhaps named after that city of Bozrah. We talked about the name Teman, who was one of the chief descendants of Edom. The rocky plateaus of the area of Turkestan are called the Tamani. In Turkestan, in Central Asia, there's a city called Amalek, very much like the Amalekites. These names of Amalek, or the Amalekites, Teman, are, again, attached to various locations and regions throughout this area. So it seems that the people of Turkey, the Turkish people, are a kind of a mixed people that does include a number of descendants of Edom, but you can't, again, really draw a boundary around some geographical area and say, well, that is Edom. The tribes are all kind of mixed together, and Edom is in that mix among those in the Middle East today. And we see what's happening among those tribes, among those people in the Middle East. We see the hatred they have. Who do they hate the most? Nations of Jacob. They hate America. They hate Israel. They hate Western Europe. And they send their trained terrorists, and they call upon others within those countries to exercise their terroristic attacks. And we see that becoming increasingly evident in the last even just few months. Most people kind of have this sense of acceptance or dread that, you know, there's no way to stop the terrorism that's going to come out of ISIS or out of Al-Qaeda or out of Iraq. There's no way to prevent it because of the kind of warfare that they fight. The people of Edom, the descendants of Edom, are in that mix. I'm not saying that the Edomites are the ISIS or the Al-Qaeda, but they're in that group. All these tribes, all these ites that you find listed that were in that area are mingled together. And they have a couple of things in common. One, their heritage is through Esau. And secondly, their hatred for the nations of Israel. So that's something that I think is going to be significant and going to continue to develop. So, after all that, let's go spend a few minutes in the book of Obadiah. But I think that helps us to appreciate what it is that is going to be, that we find here prophesied of them, and why. Why would God single out a nation or a group of people called Edom and punish them as harshly as we are going to see is described here in this little prophecy. I think we need to again to consider that God is a God of justice, and He will respond to the cries of His people, and He will take action on their behalf. And it is most likely that the descendants of Edom are going to be a major source of the difficulties that the people of Israel will suffer. And God will repay them for that behavior. And again, it goes all the way back, as we've seen, to Jacob and Esau. Verse 1, the vision of Obadiah. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. So this is the prophecy that about nations that God will bring against the people of Edom. I do want, you might want to stick a bookmark or something in Obadiah. I want to flip around to a few other verses as we continue. Joel 3, verse 19, is one we might refer to. It talks of the destruction that will come to Edom. That's what this prophecy in Obadiah is about. Joel 3:19. This is talking about what the conditions will be like when Jesus returns. Joel is about the day of the Lord, and the last part of Joel talks about the restoration of the people of Judah and Israel. It says in Joel 3:19, Egypt shall be a desolation, and Edom a desolate wilderness. Now, if you take a look at what the area of Edom looks like now, it might be kind of hard to notice that it's more of a desolate wilderness after they're punished, but that's how they're described. Egypt will be a desolation and Edom a desolate wilderness. Why? Because of the violence against the people of Judah, for they have shed innocent blood in their land. But Judah shall abide forever. So God will restore Judah. Edom will become a desolate wilderness because of their violence against the people of Judah. Back to Obadiah. Verse 1 says, this is God's word concerning Edom. We have heard a report from the Lord, and a messenger has been sent among the nations, saying, arise, let us rise up against her for battle. A messenger of God is often an angel, and perhaps is sent to call these nations together to do battle against the people of Edom. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You shall be greatly despised. The pride of your heart has deceived you. You dwell in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high. You say in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground? Edom, the people, the descendants of Edom, were apparently a very prideful bunch of people. And although they lived in a desolate area, in this wilderness, they were able to survive there. And they imagined themselves to be important or great among the nations. God said that He would bring down that arrogant pride, and they will be despised. The capital city of Edom was called Selah. S-E-L-A, and later better known as Petra. The ruins of Petra, with which we are familiar, are historical evidence of the punishment that came on Edom. It did become a desolation, and the people were brought down. But we'll see as we continue through this chapter that there also is evidence of a future fulfillment of, or an end time fulfillment of these prophecies again against Edom, just as prophecies about Judah and Israel are often parallel or dual. There is a duality here as well. There was a historic destruction of Edom, and there will be one in the future. Though you ascend as high as the eagle, verse 4, though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down. Again, Edom had pride in the fact that their strategic location could not be conquered by any other army. in those mountains, in those with those caves, with the places they had to hide, and the strategic advantage they would have of anyone that would come in against them. They were able to hold off anyone who would attack them, and they had great pride in their independence and in their safety, living as they did up in the high areas of the cliffs. God says, I will bring you down. Verse 5, if thieves had come to you, if robbers by night, would they not have stolen till they had enough? If grape gatherers had come to you, would they not have left some gleanings? That's kind of a vague description of the kind of suffering that they would experience. I want to compare that to the prophecy in Jeremiah 49. Jeremiah, as I mentioned before, has a section here, beginning in verse 7 of chapter 49, as a prophecy against Edom. And this is the prophecy that many scholars believe where Jeremiah and Obadiah are kind of playing off each other. They have similar descriptions, and they believe because of this that perhaps they were contemporary. Again, God is able to inspire different people in different times to give these prophecies, so that's not really a great consequence. But the point is that this prophecy from chapter 49, beginning in verse 7, is about Edom. We see that in verse 7. We drop down to verse 9, Jeremiah 49, verse 9. We find some similar wording here. If grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave some gleaning grapes? If thieves by night, would they not destroy until they have enough? But I've made Esau bare. I've uncovered his secret places, and he shall not be able to hide himself. His descendants are plundered, his brethren and his neighbors, and he is no more. Again, keep that in mind. It says that Esau is no more. Remember that God had promised that he would destroy the people of Amalek, the Amalekites. We'll come back to that thought as we continue through Obadiah. But the description we find in Obadiah verse 5, about the thieves and the grape gatherers, we can compare here to Jeremiah 49. The point is that invading armies would take what they want and leave the rest behind. But God says he will completely destroy Edom. He's going to destroy them at a much greater level or in a stronger way than an invading army would do. Back to Obadiah, verse 6. Oh, how Esau shall be searched out, how his hidden treasures shall be sought after. The ruins of Petra and those other areas show that, well, there's nothing there now except these empty caves. But most likely it's where whatever treasure Esau was able to gather, the people that lived there were able to gather, maybe from their robbing or looting others and bring their treasure back to hide it in those caves. Well, they sure enough, as this prophecy said, have lost all that treasure. They were sought after, they were found, and the people of Edom were brought down low. Verse 7, all the men in your confederacy shall force you to the border. The men at peace with you shall deceive you and prevail against you. Those who eat your bread shall lay a trap for you. No one will be aware of it. There'll be something that happens to Esau, or to Edom, that would be a situation where others that they were working with turn against them. That's the sense of this prophecy. Well, there's another prophecy about Edom in Psalm 83. Let's look at that. As I mentioned, you know, when you start following this thread through the books of prophecy, you find that there are several prophecies against the people of Edom. So there must be something in God's view that's more than just some obscure little group, because he has chosen to identify them and identify a number of prophecies, the kind of punishment that will come upon them. Psalm 83, verse 1 says, "Do not keep silent, O God. Do not hold your peace. Do not be still. For behold, your enemies make a tumult. Those who hate you have lifted up their head. They have taken craftily counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered ones." So it's talking about a conspiracy, a group of people allied against the people of God. "They have come," or they have said, "Come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more." Again, what is the battle cry? What is the theme of the Arabs in the Middle East? To completely destroy the nation of Israel, to push them into the sea, to wipe them out of existence. That's what the people of that Middle East region want to do. So that's what these people are trying to accomplish. Verse 5, "They've consulted together with one consent. They form a conspiracy against you, the tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites and Moab and the Hagrites and Gebal and Abilene, Ammon and Amalek." That's the groups of people that have formed this alliance or this confederacy against Judah. It includes Edom and Amalek. So it's not just them, but it includes those. They are included among those who have banded together for the purpose of destroying the people, the descendants of Israel. So back then to Obadiah. This is very likely what is being described here. The confederacy, this group of people with which Edom and Amalek have banded or allied themselves, will turn against Edom, will turn against those descendants of Esau. Verse 8, "Will I not in that day, says the Lord, even destroy the wise men from Edom and understanding from the mountain of Esau? Then your mighty men, O Teman, will be dismayed, to the end that everyone from the mountains of Esau may be cut off by slaughter." Everyone in Esau cut off by slaughter. God says that in that day he will turn against and destroy the people of Edom. Now we know that the term "in that day" can be used in a couple of ways. It can mean the time at which God fulfills his promise. That is the day, the fulfillment of whatever prophecy or promise or statement that has been made. But that phrase is also often used in the context of the day of the Lord. That is the day when Jesus Christ will intervene. So there's at least a hint here of a future fulfillment, that in that day, in the time of the intervention of Jesus Christ at the end of the age, he will cut off the wise men from Esau and cut off all of them by slaughter. Verse 10. "Why is this going to take place? Why will East Edom be punished in this way? For violence against your brother Jacob." Because of their violence, not only are they just violent by nature, but they are violent against their own family. And that's the kind of the irony, in a sense, of this relationship between the descendants of Jacob and Esau. We're family. And yet, the hostility that was born from the very beginning at the stealing of the birthright and the blessing. "For violence against your brother." We might look briefly at Amos chapter 1. Amos, the first chapter, verse 11. We went through the book of Amos some time ago. Amos, in his opening chapter, lists prophecies against a number of non-Israelite nations. One of them is Edom. Amos 1, verse 11. "For three transgressions of Edom and for four." And remember this, that "for three" and even "for four" is an idiom in the Hebrew that means "for these many reasons," or "these many transgressions." "For three transgressions of Edom and for four, I will not turn away his punishment." Why? "Because he pursued his brother with the sword." You know, other nations are used against Israel. you know, Assyria and Egypt and other nations are mentioned, but only in the context of Esau or Edom is it said that your brother, again, the emphasis over and over again is about the connection, the family relationship. Because he pursued his brother with the sword and cast off all pity. His anger tore perpetually and he kept his wrath forever. That, again, explains some of the origin of this relationship between the people of Edom and the people of Israel. Back to Obadiah, again in verse 10. For violence against your brother Jacob, shame will cover you, and you will be cut off forever. You see, we keep running into that phrase, don't we? That God is going to slaughter all of them. He's going to cut them off. He's going to destroy the name of Amalek. Continue in verse 11. In the day that you stood on the other side, in other words, when he stood against Judah, in the day that strangers carried captive his forces, when foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, even you were as one of them. Edom, apparently, stood in support of Babylon when Judah was overrun and taken captive. The people of Edom stood back and they gloated at the defeats. They celebrated the destruction of the people of Judah because of this innate hostility that they had, the resentment over the blessings that were part of Judah or given to them. At the end of verse 11, even you were as one of them. So they weren't literally part of the invading armies of Babylon, but they certainly took their side. They were cheering them on as if you were one of them. But you should not have gazed on that on the day of your brother in the day of his captivity. You should not have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction, nor should you have spoken proudly in their day of distress. You should not have entered the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. This gives the sense that the people of Edom were watching all this occur and even went in afterwards and looted the city when the Babylonians were through, taking advantage of the destruction of the people of Judah at the time they were carried into captivity. You should not have gazed on their affliction in the day of their calamity nor laid hands on their substance in the day of their calamity. You should not have stood at the crossroads to cut off those among them who had escaped. Apparently, again, they were part of this scene where if people were trying to escape from the hands of the Babylonians, the Edomites were apparently there to capture them and deliver them back. So they were part of this whole scene of the destruction of Jerusalem. Verse 15. This takes us then into the future. We've been reading about some of the things that Edom did at the time that Judah was taken into captivity in the 580s BC. Verse 15. For the day of the Lord upon all the nations is near. This is the day of the justice that Jesus Christ will administer on the nations of the earth. The day of the Lord upon all nations is near. And as you have done, it shall be done to you. Your reprisal shall return upon your own head. This would indicate that at the end of the age, Edom will receive what they've given. They will get as they gave. As they will, at the end of the age, mistreat the people, the descendants of Israel, they will themselves be punished in the same way. Verse 16, for as you drank on my holy mountain, so all the nations will drink continually. In other words, again, they will get what they had dished out to others. And then at the end of verse 16, they shall be as though they had never been. Continue on. There's that thought that keeps coming back of the destruction of all of the people of Esau, or of Edom. Now, verse 17 speaks of the deliverance of the people of Judah, that Mount Zion will be delivered. The house of Jacob will receive their possessions. So the nations of Israel will be restored at the time when Jesus Christ returns. That's a theme that runs throughout all of the prophets, and the minor prophets in particular. The house of Jacob shall be a fire, the house of Joseph a flame, but the house of Esau shall be stubble. Yeah, Israel, Jacob and Joseph will suffer. There will be a flame. There will be some damage and some loss to those people. But Esau will be burned to the ground. Esau will be a stubble. They shall kindle them and devour them. No survivor shall remain of the house of Esau. That's quite a statement, quite a prophecy. With that in mind, consider again Jeremiah 49. The prophecy there that's similar to Obadiah, chapter 49, verse 18. Jeremiah 49, 18. This is a description of the end result of the punishment that will come upon Edom. As in the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, what is there left of Sodom and Gomorrah? Nothing, only their history. There's nothing left of Sodom and Gomorrah and their neighbors. So as in the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah and their neighbors, says the Lord, no one shall remain there, nor shall a son of man dwell in it. This is a prophecy against Edom. Now, I don't know how literally to take these prophecies. Obviously, Edom will suffer terribly because of their sins against the people of Israel. I'm suggesting that many of those sins, the brutality waged against the nations of Israel, are still in the future. And the reason that Edom is going to be punished so severely is because, as we saw earlier, of the brutality and the hostility and the violence that they exhibit against the people of Israel, their brothers. And they will become as Sodom and Gomorrah. And as it says here in verse 18, no survivor shall remain of the house of Esau. So I ask it as a question. Is it possible that there will be no descendants of Edom in the millennium? No direct descendants of Edom in the millennium. We've come across a number of statements, passages, or even just hints that the people of Edom will not have any survivors. They will be destroyed. Their name will be removed. Is it possible that as Jesus Christ works with the other nations to establish peace at his return, would it be maybe solve half the problem if one of the parties just wasn't there? That the people of Edom just will not be there at the beginning of the millennium. And Jesus Christ will work with the other nations, and he will establish peace with and deal with the people of Edom in the time of the White Throne Judgment. I present that more just as a question, because again, I'm not sure exactly how literally we should take these words of this prophecy, but it seems to be pretty explicit, pretty direct, that there would not be survivors. Then the next verse, 19, goes on again to describe the restoration of the people of Judah and Israel. They shall possess the fields of Ephraim and the fields of Samaria. Benjamin will possess Gilead. The captives of this host of the children of Israel shall possess the land of the Canaanites as far as Zarephath. You see, after Jesus Christ returns, we know that Israel will be restored to the land that God had promised to them. Israel never fully occupied Canaan. The Canaanites, the Philistines, all those ites were always there through the history of Israel, always causing problems. Jesus Christ is going to come back and he's going to do what Israel was supposed to do. He's going to sanitize the land. And for the first time, Israel is going to fully occupy and fully receive the promises that were given to Abraham. Although Israel was established there, they never fully received those promises because the Canaanites and all those tribes were always there. They never fully were taken away. But Jesus Christ will restore the captives of Israel, put them back in the land that was given to them by right of birth through Abraham, and he will restore that land. He will put them in that land, and not just restore it, but give them their full inheritance in a physical sense for the first time after he returns. Verse 21, then saviors will come to Mount Zion. The word saviors doesn't mean a savior in a spiritual sense, but it means a deliverer, ones who bring the people through and establish them and bring them to restore the people of Israel in the mountains of Esau. And the kingdom shall be the Lord's. Jesus Christ will have full control. And there are no longer going to be any little ites running around causing problems for the Israelites. They're going to be established in their land, really for the very first time. And they'll be delivered and set up, and they will fully receive the blessings that were bestowed upon them through Abraham's, through what was given to Abraham. I just want to read in conclusion one quote from the Nelson Study Bible on this particular passage here at the end of Obadiah. It says, these were Obadiah's last words against all human arrogance, pride, and rebellion. Edom had thought itself indestructible, but the Lord humbled that nation and restored the fallen Judah. Many people are tempted to consider themselves beyond the reach of God, but God will bring them low, just as he will lift those who humble themselves before him. And it concludes, one great day he will establish his just rule over all. That's what we just came home from celebrating, isn't it? That time when Jesus Christ will establish his rule over all the nations. And in doing so, he will deal, first of all, with those, with all the nations, as we saw in verse 15, the day of the Lord upon all nations will come about, and Jesus Christ will execute justice and judgment in order to restore his people. So I find the study of Obadiah itself to be interesting, and especially in light of the backstory. Who was Edom, and how are they connected to or related to Jacob, the people, the descendants of Jacob, and why is God so harsh against the people of Edom? Much more harsh in dealing with them than he is with Assyria or with Egypt or any of the other nations. And we see, maybe understand a little better why that is to be as we look at the story that is behind the book of Obadiah. One last thought, I forgot to mention this at the outset, that there is a copy of the Life, Hope, and Truth article on an overview of the book of Obadiah at the information table. I didn't make enough for everyone to take a copy. I've had in mind primarily those who don't have access to the internet. If you have access to the internet, you can look up this overview of Obadiah on the Life, Hope, and Truth website. So that will conclude our study this afternoon on the book of Obadiah.